A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He wants to know about the history of monasteries, and, more specifically, how many people today actually belong to monastic orders. It's one of those questions where you realize you have a mental image of monks from movies and medieval manuscripts, but no real sense of whether the whole institution is thriving, or basically a historical reenactment at this point.
The answer is genuinely surprising in both directions. It's declining dramatically in the West, but globally, monasticism is far from dead. There are parts of the world where it's actually holding steady or even growing. The numbers tell a story most people never hear.
Before we get into that, quick note. DeepSeek V4 Pro is writing our script today. There, I said it.
So let's start with the obvious framing question. When we say monastic orders, what are we actually counting? Because the term covers an enormous range. Catholic religious orders, Orthodox monastic communities, Buddhist sanghas, Hindu sattus, Jain ascetics, certain Sufi tariqas. Even within Christianity alone, you've got Benedictines, Franciscans, Dominicans, Jesuits, Carthusians, Trappists, and dozens more. Each with different rules, different vows, different ways of counting who belongs.
That's before you get into the distinction between monks and friars, which I know you're going to want to clarify because you're you.
I am absolutely going to clarify that. Monks traditionally live in a stable community, a monastery, under a rule. The Benedictine motto is, ora et labora, pray and work. They're attached to a place. Friars, by contrast, emerged in the 13th century. Franciscans, Dominicans, and their mendicant. They move around, they beg, they preach in towns, different vocation, different structure. But for statistical purposes, the Vatican's Central Office for Religious Life tends to lump them together under consecrated religious. So when we tot numbers, we need to know what bucket we're using.
So let's start with the Catholic Church, since it actually publishes data. What's the big picture?
The Vatican Statistical Yearbook, the Annuario Pontificio, and the annual report from the Congregation for Institutes of Consecrated Life, now called the Dicastery for Institutes of Consecrated Life, give us a pretty clear trajectory. In 1970, there were roughly 1.2 million Catholic religious sisters worldwide. By 2022, that number had fallen to about 580,000, so more than halved. For religious brothers and ordained monks, the peak was around 1970 as well, roughly 200,000, and now it's closer to 110,000.
Catholic monastic and religious life has lost something like half its members in 50 years. That's a collapse, not a gentle decline.
A collapse concentrated almost entirely in Europe and North America. In 1965, there were about 180,000 women religious in the United States alone. Today, it's around 35,000. The median age of a Catholic sister in the U.S. is now over 80. That's not a statistic you recover from.
So, most American nuns are literally grandmothers. Grandmothers who took vows of celibacy and poverty 6 decades ago.
Many of them are still active, still running schools and hospitals and social services, but the pipeline behind them is a trickle. The number of new entrants to religious life in the U.S. is in the low hundreds per year. Some orders haven't had a novice in 20 years.
You said globally it's not all decline. Where's the counterweight?
Africa and Asia. Between 2000 and 2022, the number of Catholic religious sisters in Africa grew by about 30%, from roughly 55,000 to over 70,000. In Asia, it grew from about 150,000 to over 170,000. Vietnam alone has been producing large numbers of vocations. India as well. The church in Nigeria has seen significant growth in religious life. So the center of gravity is shifting south and east, which mirrors the broader demographic shift in global Christianity.
For men's orders?
Similar pattern, though the overall numbers are smaller. Africa went from about 9,000 religious brothers and priests in religious orders in 2000 to over 13,000 by 2022. Asia from about 24,000 to over 30,000. Meanwhile, Europe dropped from roughly 90,000 to about 55,000 in the same period.
If you're a young Catholic in Milan or Boston considering monastic life, you're unusual. If you're a young Catholic in Lagos or Ho Chi Minh City, you're part of a growing trend.
And that shift has real cultural implications. The traditional monastic centers, Monte Cassino, Cluny, Solsmes, are emptying out or being consolidated. But new monasteries are being founded in places like Kerala, in Kenya, in the Philippines. The Trappists, for example, have a thriving monastery in Uganda, Our Lady of Victoria, that was founded in the 1950s and now has a large community of Ugandan monks.
Let's zoom out from Catholicism. Buddhism is the other major tradition where monasticism is central. What do those numbers look like?
This is harder to pin down precisely because there's no central Buddhist authority equivalent to the Vatican. But we have good estimates. The total number of Buddhist monastics worldwide is somewhere between 1.5 and 2 million. The vast majority are in Asia. China alone has an estimated 200,000 Buddhist monks and nuns, though that number fluctuates with government policy. Thailand has around 300,000. Myanmar, before the recent conflicts, had roughly 500,000. Sri Lanka has about 30,000 fully ordained monks.
Unlike Catholic orders, some of these populations are relatively stable, aren't they? The institution of temporary ordination changes the math.
This is a crucial distinction. In Theravada Buddhist countries like Thailand, Myanmar, and Cambodia, it's common for young men to ordain temporarily, a few weeks, a few months, sometimes a year. It's seen as a rite of passage, a way of making merit for one's family. So the number of people who have been monks at some point in their lives is vastly larger than the number of permanent, lifelong monastics. In Thailand, something like 90% of Buddhist men will ordain at some point, usually before marriage. The permanent monastic core is much smaller, perhaps 50 to 60,000 in Thailand who are monks for life.
The institution of the monastery is woven into ordinary life in a way that it simply isn't in the modern West. Every family has a son or a cousin who's done a stint in robes.
That changes how the public relates to monasteries. They're not exotic or remote. They're part of the social fabric. The monastery is where you go for a meditation retreat, where you bring food for alms rounds in the morning, where your nephew is staying for a few months before university. It's integrated.
Whereas in the West, the monastery has become this almost romanticized other, a place of silence and mystery that most people will never set foot in.
And that romanticization has a history worth tracing, because it connects directly to why Western monasteries emptied out in the first place.
Let's do the history then. Where do monasteries even come from?
The Christian monastic tradition traces back to the 3rd and 4th centuries, the Desert Fathers and Mothers in Egypt, Anthony the Great, Pachomius, Syncletica. They withdrew from Roman society, went into the Egyptian desert, and created communities devoted entirely to prayer and asceticism. Anthony is traditionally dated to around 270 to 356 AD. He didn't invent monasticism. There were already Jewish ascetic communities, the Essenes, and of course Buddhist monasticism predates Christianity by about 500 years, but Anthony became the archetype.
The Buddha's Sangha, his monastic community, was founded in the 5th century BC. So by the time Anthony wandered into the desert, Buddhist monasteries had already been operating for 8 centuries.
They had developed sophisticated rules, the Vinaya, governing everything from how robes are made to how disputes are settled. The Buddhist monastic code is extraordinarily detailed. There are 227 precepts for fully ordained monks in the Theravada tradition, covering everything from the obvious, no killing, no stealing, no lying, to the remarkably specific, like not digging in the ground for fear of harming insects, not accepting gold or silver, not eating after midday.
I've always found the Vinaya fascinating because it's essentially an operating system for a self-governing community. Every conceivable edge case gets addressed.
That's what makes it durable. The same is true of the rule of Saint Benedict, written in the 6th century. Benedict didn't create the first Western monastic rule, but his became the standard. It's practical. It specifies how many psalms to pray at each office, when to eat, what to eat, how to welcome guests, how to elect an abbot, how to correct faults. It's not a treatise on mystical theology. It's a manual for running a community of flawed human beings who've committed to seeking God together.
The genius of Benedict is that he's not asking for heroic feats of asceticism. He calls his rule a little rule for beginners. The point is sustainability, not spectacle.
And it worked. By the High Middle Ages, there were thousands of Benedictine monasteries across Europe. Cluny, founded in 910, became the center of a vast network of daughter houses. At its peak in the 12th century, the Cluniac order had over 1,000 monasteries. The Cistercians, founded in 1098 as a reform movement calling for stricter observance of the rule, spread even faster. By the end of the 12th century, there were over 500 Cistercian abbeys.
These weren't just prayer factories. They were economic engines. Cistercian monasteries, in particular, were at the forefront of medieval technological innovation. They developed hydraulic systems for powering mills, draining marshland, irrigating fields. They were the closest thing the 12th century had to industrial research parks.
The wool trade made many Cistercian houses enormously wealthy. Fountains Abbey and Rival in Yorkshire ran sheep flocks in the tens of thousands. That wealth, ironically, became a problem. The cycle of reform and decline is one of the most persistent patterns in monastic history. A reform movement starts with strict observance and poverty. It attracts followers. Prosperity leads to relaxation. Someone calls for reform. A new order splits off.
The Benedictines begat the Cistercians, who begat the Trappists. The Franciscans split into conventuals and spirituals within a century of Francis's death. Every generation produces someone who looks at the existing monasteries and says, "You've gotten comfortable. Let's go back to the desert."
That brings us to the Reformation, which is the single biggest rupture in the history of Western monasticism. In England, Henry VIII dissolved the monasteries between 1536 and 1541. Over 800 religious houses were closed. Their lands were seized and sold. The monastic population of England went from about 12,000 to zero in 5 years. Similar suppressions happened across much of Protestant Europe, the German states, the Netherlands, Scandinavia. Entire monastic traditions were extinguished.
There's a specific number I've seen, something like how many religious houses were dissolved across Europe during the Reformation.
It's hard to get a precise total, but in England alone it was over 800. In Germany, the secularization of monastic lands happened more gradually, but by the end of the Thirty Years' War, vast numbers of monasteries had been dissolved or converted to other uses. The French Revolution delivered another massive blow. In 1790, the revolutionary government abolished all religious orders in France. Monks and nuns were expelled from their monasteries. Properties were nationalized. The same pattern repeated across Europe as Napoleonic reform spread.
By 1800, the thousand-year-old monastic infrastructure of Europe had been largely dismantled, and then it partially recovered in the 19th century.
There was a significant revival. New congregations were founded, especially women's apostolic orders focused on education and healthcare. The 19th century was actually a boom time for Catholic sisters in America, who built the Catholic school and hospital systems essentially from scratch. But the recovery was built on a foundation that had been shattered. And then came the 20th century's two world wars, which emptied monasteries across Europe again. And after Vatican II in the 1960s, many religious orders went through an identity crisis. What does it mean to be a religious in the modern world? Large numbers left.
The Western trajectory is explosive growth in the early and high Middle Ages, then reform cycles, then the hammer blows of Reformation and Revolution, a partial 19th century recovery, and then the post-1960s collapse. What about Eastern Orthodoxy?
Orthodox monasticism has a different shape. The model is less about distinct orders with different rules and more about individual monasteries following the same basic typikon or liturgical rule with variations. Mount Athos in Greece is the most famous center, a peninsula with 20 ruling monasteries and numerous smaller communities, skeets, and hermitages. Athos has been continuously inhabited by monks since at least the 9th century. Today, it has about 2,000 monks, which is actually up from a low of around 1,000 in the 1970s.
Athos is growing again.
There's been a revival of interest in Orthodox monasticism, particularly in Russia, Romania, and Georgia, since the fall of communism. In 1988, there were only about 21 functioning monasteries in all of Russia. By 2020, there were over 900. The Russian Orthodox Church has been rebuilding monastic life at a remarkable pace. Many of those monasteries are small, but the trajectory is upward.
900 from 21 in 30-some years. That's not just recovery, that's renaissance.
It's not just Russia. The Romanian Orthodox Church has seen similar growth, Georgia as well. There's something happening in Orthodox countries that looks quite different from the Western Catholic pattern. Part of it is national identity, the monastery as a symbol of cultural survival through communism. Part of it is a genuine spiritual revival. The numbers aren't vast in absolute terms. We're talking tens of thousands, not hundreds of thousands, but the direction is the opposite of what you see in Western Europe.
Let's go back to the global numbers for a minute. If we add everything up, Catholic religious, Orthodox monastics, Buddhist monastics, Hindu sadhus, Jain ascetics, what's the rough total of people living under some form of monastic or religious vows today?
The best estimate I've seen, aggregating across traditions, is somewhere between 3 and 4 million people worldwide. Catholic religious account for about 700,000 of that. Buddhist monastics are the largest single block, probably between 1.5 and 2 million. Hindu sadhus and sannyasins are estimated at anywhere from 2 to 5 million, but that number is extremely soft because there's no central registry and the category is porous. Some are lifelong renunciates, others are seasonal or temporary.
We're looking at a global monastic population that's roughly the size of Los Angeles, spread across every continent, embedded in traditions that are in some cases 2.5 millennia old.
That's not counting the lay associates and oblates, people who take some form of commitment to a monastic community while living ordinary lives in the world. Benedictine oblates, for example, are lay people who affiliate with a particular monastery, follow a modified rule of life, and participate in the community's prayer from a distance. The number of oblates in the U.S. has actually been growing, even as the number of professed monks declines. Some monasteries have hundreds of oblates attached to them.
That's an interesting adaptation. The monastery is a spiritual center for a dispersed community rather than a residential one. It's almost a distributed monasticism.
It raises a question about what monasticism even is in the 21st century. Is it defined by physical enclosure, by a literal leaving of the world? Or is it defined by a rule of life and a commitment to prayer and community, even if you have a day job and a family? Different traditions answer this differently. The Catholic Church's canon law defines religious life in terms of public vows of poverty, chastity, and obedience lived in community. But the boundaries are blurrier than they used to be.
You mentioned earlier that the median age of American nuns is over 80. What happens when they're gone? Do the institutions they built just vanish?
Some of them will, inevitably. But many orders have been transferring their institutions, hospitals, universities, social service agencies, to lay boards and professional management. The Sisters of Mercy, for example, founded dozens of hospitals across the U.S. Most of those are now run by large healthcare systems, with the sisters themselves serving on boards or in chaplaincy roles rather than as nurses and administrators. The physical monastery buildings are a harder problem. A lot of them are being sold, converted into retreat centers, senior living facilities, sometimes even hotels. There's a former Trappist monastery in Massachusetts that's now a luxury spa.
From Aura and Labora to hot stone massages in cucumber water.
I'm not sure St. Benedict would approve, but the buildings are magnificent and someone has to maintain them. The alternative is demolition or slow decay, which is happening to a lot of monastery ruins across Europe that nobody has the resources to preserve.
Let's talk about the economic model, because I think most people have no idea how monasteries actually support themselves. The popular image is still medieval. Monks copying manuscripts, nuns making cheese or jam.
Some of that still exists. The Trappists are famous for their beer. Chimay, Orval, Westvleteren, and those breweries generate significant revenue. Westvleteren in Belgium produces a tiny quantity and sells it directly from the monastery gate, yet it's consistently rated among the best beers in the world. The monks deliberately limit production because, in their words, we are monks, not brewers. But for most monasteries, the economics are more mundane. Some run guest houses and retreat centers. Some have farms or vineyards. Many rely on donations, endowments, and the pensions of elderly members.
What about Buddhist monasteries? How do they fund themselves?
Primarily through donations from the lay community. In Theravada countries, the daily alms round is both a spiritual practice and an economic mechanism. Monks go out with bowls each morning, and lay people put food in them. It's a direct transfer that's been happening every morning for over 2,000 years. Larger monasteries may also receive government support, land endowments, or run schools and clinics. In China and Taiwan, sub-Buddhist organizations have become quite sophisticated economically. For Guangshan, for example, operates universities, a television station, publishing houses, and museums. It's a global operation with hundreds of branch temples.
You've got everything from the Carthusians, who live in near total solitude and silence, to Fo Guangshan, which is basically a multinational enterprise with a Dharma mission. The diversity within the category, monasticism, is staggering.
That diversity makes the statistics tricky. When someone asks how many monastics there are, you have to ask, are we counting the Carthusian hermit who speaks to another human being once a week? The Thai teenager who ordains for 3 months? The Vietnamese Buddhist nun running an orphanage? The Benedictine oblate who works in an office and prays the liturgy of the hours on her phone? All of these are real expressions of monastic life, but they're radically different.
One thing I want to dig into. Why did Western monasticism collapse so thoroughly after the 1960s? You mentioned Vatican II, but that feels like an incomplete explanation. Plenty of institutions went through upheaval in the 60s without losing half their members in a generation.
It's a combination of factors. Vatican II's document on religious life, Perfecta Caritatis, called for orders to return to the charism of their founders and adapt to modern conditions. That led many communities to drop distinctive practices, habits, cloister, common schedules, in favor of more individualized lifestyles. For some, that was liberating. For others, it eroded the very thing that made religious life distinct. If you're living in an apartment, wearing ordinary clothes, and working a regular job, in what sense are you a nun rather than a single Catholic woman with a strong prayer life?
The identity became fuzzy.
At the same time, the broader culture was changing. Women had vastly expanded professional opportunities. The nun who might have become a hospital administrator in 1950 could become a hospital administrator in 1970 without taking vows of poverty and celibacy. The opportunity cost of religious life went way up. Plus, the sexual revolution made celibacy seem stranger than it had in a more restrained culture. And the broader decline in religious practice across the West meant the pool of potential vocations was shrinking anyway.
It was a perfect storm. Theological uncertainty, expanding secular opportunities, cultural shifts around sex and authority, and a shrinking base of religiously observant young people.
Similar dynamics are now appearing in some Buddhist countries as they develop economically and secularize. Thailand and South Korea have seen declines in monastic vocations, though from much higher bases. When young people have more options, fewer choose a life of renunciation. That's not a surprising pattern.
Though it raises an interesting question about whether monasticism requires a certain level of economic constraint to thrive. If everyone can afford Netflix and air conditioning, does the monastery lose its appeal? Or does it become appealing for entirely different reasons?
There's some evidence for the latter. In the West, the people entering monasteries today are often not running away from poverty or limited options. They're often well-educated, had careers, and are making a deliberate countercultural choice. The monastery becomes attractive precisely because it offers something the wider culture doesn't: silence, stability, community, a rhythm of life not dictated by the market or social media. The question is whether that appeal can generate enough vocations to sustain institutions that were built for much larger populations.
The numbers suggest not, at least in the West. But the African and Asian growth you mentioned complicates the story. Maybe we're not watching the death of monasticism so much as its relocation.
That's the optimistic reading. The pessimistic reading is that the African and Asian growth may follow the same trajectory as Western growth did, a boom period followed by secularization and decline. South Korea was one of the great Catholic success stories of the 20th century, with explosive growth in vocations. Now it's seeing a slowdown. Vietnam and Nigeria may be where South Korea was 30 years ago. The long-term trend is uncertain.
One thing that strikes me, going back to the history, is how resilient monasteries have proven across centuries. They've been suppressed, dissolved, burned, secularized, and emptied by revolution. And they keep coming back in new forms, in new places, The Desert Fathers didn't imagine Cistercian abbeys. St. Benedict didn't imagine Fo Guangshan. But the impulse keeps reasserting itself.
The impulse to withdraw, to create a community organized around something other than production and consumption and family, that seems to be a recurring feature of human civilization. It shows up across cultures and eras. Whether it's growing or shrinking at any given moment, it's not going away.
The numbers, when you actually look at them, are bigger than most people would guess. 3 to 4 million people worldwide have chosen to live under vows, in community, oriented towards something they consider transcendent. That's not a rounding error. That's a small country.
A small country scattered across the globe, speaking dozens of languages, practicing traditions that range from 200 to 2500 years old. Most of its citizens will never meet each other. But they're recognizably part of the same enterprise. The project of organizing a human life around silence, prayer, and community, rather than around career, consumption, and romantic partnership.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In 1952, a blue whale off the coast of South America produced a call measured at 188 decibels. If you convert that to the scale used for terrestrial sounds, adjusting for the density difference between water and air, it clocks in at roughly 161 decibels, which is louder than a jet engine at takeoff. A single blue whale can acoustically dominate an area the size of the Caribbean.
A whale can shout louder than a 747 at full throttle.
I'm just imagining the poor fish.
This has been My Weird Prompts. Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop, and thanks to Daniel for the question. If you enjoyed this, leave us a review wherever you get your podcasts. It helps. We're back soon.
This episode was generated using Gemini Flash 3. Text-to-speech engine was Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too, from half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time, stay curious, keep weird in mind.